Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility that a bipartisan bill on immigration reform will be introduced in the Senate this week and speak with Angela Maria Kelly, Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, who is Director of the Immigration Policy Center and prior to that was the Deputy Director of the National Immigration Forum. She's the author of a new report, which is an economic analysis on the impact of legalizing 11 million immigrants now living and working in the shadows. Then we'll look into the chances of any restrictions on criminals and the mentally ill obtaining firearms passing in the Senate, given the threat of a filibuster by Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio. William Vizard, a veteran in law enforcement who was a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms and is the author of Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and the Symbolism of Gun Control, joins us. We will discuss the impasse over gun safety with the president determined to prevent another massacre like Newtown and senators beholden to the NRA equally determined to block any gun control measures. Then finally, we'll examine the paradox that in spite of the bigotry and banning of gay marriage, gay adoption has proceeded apace and largely under the radar. Alison Gash, a professor of political science at the University of Oregon and author of the forthcoming book Below the Radar, How Silence Can Save Civil Rights, joins us. She has an article at the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Rights to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. And joining us now is Angela Maria Kelly, who's Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, a well-known authority on the policy and the politics of immigration. She has published numerous impactful reports on the economic value of immigration reform, the costs of mass deportation, and the integration trends of Americans newcomers. Previously, she served as Director of the Immigration Policy Center, and prior to that was Deputy Director of the National Immigration Forum. She's the author of a new report released by the Center for American Progress, an economic analysis on the impact of legalizing 11 million immigrants now living and working in the shadows. Welcome to Background Briefing, Angela Maria Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me.
And there's a little bit of confusion given the senators all appearing on the Sunday morning talk shows, members of the Gang of Eight who are looking into coming up with bipartisan immigration reform. Lindsey Graham says that it's happening, the deal is done. And then you've got Marco Rubio saying, no, the deal is not done. Chuck Schumer saying the deal is close at hand. What do you make of that?
Well, it sounds like it's recess, and you've got eight members in eight different places at a time where their staff have been busily working away, and so they haven't all gotten on the same set of talking points. I don't think, though, that those differences are particularly substantial. I think it is the case that they're all moving in the right direction. They're very, very close, if not in complete agreement on a deal. And look, it's a complex issue. The immigration code is more complex than the tax code. And we're talking about a major rewrite of immigration law. And so, you know, there's going to be times where people feel like they're closer to being done than other times. But I have no doubt that particularly when they come back in a week's time and staff have bill text to present to them, that we will all be declaring unanimously that there is a bill and that it'll start being considered in the Senate.
Well, already, though, Lindsey Graham has indicated his objections to the idea of immigration reform being based upon family needs rather than economic needs. And that does seem a little callous, but I guess it does essentially lead to this meeting that's taken place between the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce about the arguments have been over future flows of immigration, how many guest workers could be allowed into the country to relieve labor shortages and in which industries and how much they would get paid. So is that, in other words, does economic interest trump moral concerns?
Well, I don't think that you have to put them in opposition of each other. It's not an either or. Family immigration has been the cornerstone of our immigration policy. The thinking being that you, if you come to this country, that you're going to want to have your closest of family members with you, your spouse, your children, your parents. And so we have a, you know, complex family visa system that, depending on the closeness of that relationship, you do or you don't have a waiting time. And in some cases, there's very long waiting periods. So it's not a system that's functioned particularly well. But it is the case that family members who come in are also themselves economic actors. They often permit the family as a unit to be stronger and to be more economically viable and vibrant than it would be otherwise. You know, a classic example is if you have your mother living with you and you have young children, that might permit the mother to go work outside the home along with the husband because there's a grandparent in the house taking care of the children. And, you know, the stories like that go on and on. So it's not a real black or white where you're either here to only work or here only as a family member. I think what Lindsey Graham wants to do, and all the senators share this, is a desire to step back and look at our overall immigration system and make some assessments about what is in the country's self-best interest, what can we do to keep ourselves as an attractive nation that people want to come to work, and to know that they can bring their family members, and how do we structure that in a way that's responsive to, you know, what's a very dynamic economy, as opposed to the static visa numbers that we have now. So that's a tall order, and it's a tall order for any policymaker, but particularly when you have, you know, four that have the letter D after their name and four that have the letter R after their name, it's unusual that you would have a bipartisan agreement on such a complex topic with clear political overtones. Yet, it seems like that's what we're getting to, and I think it's something to cheer about.
Again, I'm speaking with Angela Maria Keller, who's Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress. Previously, she served as Director of the Immigration Policy Center, and prior to that was Deputy Director of the National Immigration Forum. She's the author of a new report, An Economic Analysis on the Impact of Legalizing 11 Million Immigrants Now Living and Working in the Shadows. Now, it is unusual that the United States Senate, which has been famous for its obstruction of both appointments to the Obama administration, and they've broken new ground with Chuck Hagel, John Brennan, Senators Kathleen Sebelius and Jacob Lew had to basically thousands of written questions, even though they passed him. They're holding up a bunch of people as well from EPA and Labor Secretary's being held up at the moment, not to mention almost all of Obama's judicial nominees, particularly on the in critical Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., where there are still four vacancies, one of which is the Chief Justice going back to 2005. So you have a dysfunction there and a kind of jihad on the part of the Republicans to deny the president his appointments and particularly to level the playing field in our judiciary, which is heavily slanted in a conservative direction as a result of Republican obstruction. So I assume that the reason that the Republicans have made an exception to their scorched earth policy here is because of the wake-up call from this last election where they realized that Latinos weren't voting for them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the policy and the politics are coming together nicely around this issue, unlike many issues, as you just described. I mean, certainly from a political standpoint, both parties recognize the growing clout of the Latino community and their keen attention and interest in this issue. It's very personal for Latinos. You know, two-thirds of Latinos who are voters know someone who's undocumented. A high percentage of them know somebody who has been deported, and over 10% are related to someone who's undocumented. So this isn't an esoteric, theoretical issue for Latino voters. It's a very personal one. And I really think that the last election, where you had such a stark contrast with Mitt Romney as the Republican candidate talking about self-deportation and embracing the Arizona immigration laws, saying he would veto the DREAM Act for undocumented kids. You know, it really made it easier, frankly, for Latinos to know who was in their court, particularly because the president very shrewdly in June granted deferred action or a protection for 2 years, if you will, to DREAMers, to undocumented youth. And so that, you know, that made a clear choice for Latinos, but that didn't solve the problem, right? We're not done. And so now it's a question of can the Democrats deliver and move an immigration bill? Will the Republicans oppose it, or will they get behind it and try to soften their image with this block of voters? And what will the president do? And how much of a role will he be seen as playing, you know, to advance the ball down the field? So there are a lot of different players, but all are being watched carefully by a very educated and attuned electorate in Latinos. If you watch Univision, or, you know, even if you don't speak Spanish, the topic of immigration just permeates the show because it is just such an important issue for the Latino community. From a policy perspective, there's a lot that's gone on in the last many years since Congress last looked at the immigration issue in 2007. There's been an enormous buildup at the border. There's much greater border security than we've ever had in the past. It's not perfect, and it never will be, but and that's an ongoing policy priority, of course, that we need to keep investing in. There's been a record number of people deported under President Obama. He deported more folks in just a few years than Bush did in eight. And so he is a president who has shown himself to be tough on enforcement. And I think the experiment of a lot of the state laws, the Arizonas, the Alabamas, which resulted in a lot of attention and a lot of lawsuits, but not a lot of immigrants leaving. So we still have 11 million undocumented people here without papers, and they may have moved to a friendlier state. But they're not going home the way some want them to because they are home. And I think those are just a number of reasons why the moment has come. As you pointed out, those other issues that aren't making progress, where there isn't traction and where there is this bitter partisanship, this does seem to be the one sweet spot, if you will, where lawmakers, where they don't, you know, scream at each other and kick over chairs, but they actually sit down and are drafting legislation. It's really a breath of fresh air.
Well, of course, it may indicate the extent to which, as you know, Angela Maria Kelly, there was a recent autopsy on the part of the RNC, the Republican National Committee, at why they lost and what they can do about not losing again, particularly the White House. And in many ways, it seemed like a public relations approach to a problem rather than a real change of heart. And of course, to illustrate my cynicism, the congressman from Alaska, Don Young, made the most appalling remarks the other day on talk radio in Alaska, which indicates that bigotry is still alive and well and in Republican circles.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, look, sadly, there have been a number of comments like that from lawmakers saying that we should have electric fences, likening immigrants to dogs, that we should use cattle prods, shoot them from helicopters. I mean, these are coming from the mouths of, you know, not angry teenagers, but elected officials. So there is a lot of that just extreme, unacceptable rhetoric out there. But I do think that there is a much more sober and somber center that's emerging. And a number of Republicans, look, including Rand Paul and Raul Labrador, a Tea Party darling from Idaho, of course, Senator Paul from Kentucky, talked about immigration in very personal, glowing terms just a few weeks ago. And so I think that while they're very loud, these extreme voices in the Republican Party, I don't know that they're as large as they used to be. And I think that the public generally, you know, polling is beginning to show this isn't just popular with Latinos, it's popular with everybody because, look, just, you know, like, deal with the problem. There's such exasperation at our lawmakers that can't actually pass laws anymore, and a recognition that we're not going to deport 11 million people. It's not in our interest. And as we tried to show, just from a, you know, dollars and cents perspective, it would make a lot of sense to give undocumented immigrants legal status and then citizenship. It increases our GDP. They would make more money. They would spend more money. They would pay more in taxes. And this would put extra dollars in everybody's pocketbook. And so there's a number of reasons why I think this is not going to be easy. If it were easy, it would have already been done. But I do think it's doable, and that this is probably the year for immigration to finally get settled.
So in terms of your new report at the Center for American Progress, Angela Mira Kelly, on the economic analysis on the impact of legalizing 11 million immigrants now living and working in the shadows, you just mentioned it in passing there. Give us some more details about how what is the Treasury losing now in terms of this underground labor market, and what would it gain in terms of people coming out of the shadows and paying taxes and et cetera?
Great question. So we had an economist look at the 10-year economic impact of immigration reform under three scenarios. The first scenario is that you give people who are here without papers, the 11 million, legal status and citizenship right away. The other is that you give them legal status in 2013, and then in 5 years they get citizenship. And the third scenario says that just for 10 years we'll give them just legal status, but they're not yet able to become citizens. And so it's an interesting analysis because it not only shows just the value of having legal status, but it also shows the value of being able to bump up, if you will, from having just a green card or just legal status to actual citizenship. So if we could wave a magic wand and give citizenship to all the 11 million, we would grow the GDP by an additional $1.4 trillion cumulatively over the next 10 years. Americans would earn an additional $791 billion in personal income over that same period of time. And the economy would create an average of an additional 203,000 jobs per year. So that's if we could just wave a magic wand and have citizenship happen right away, which is probably not going to be the case. If you have a five-year delay, you still have a $1.1 trillion increase in GDP. You still have $603 billion added to Americans' income. If you wait 10 years, it's still not bad. You get an increase in GDP of $832 billion. It's more modest, but it's not insignificant. And you see an increase in the incomes of Americans, $470 billion over 10 years. And these numbers are all on our report, which is at AmericanProgress.org, if your listeners want to get more details, because I'm just skimming over it. But the notion is to think very methodically and unemotionally about what's the economic impact of giving people legal status. Right now we know that about two-thirds of the undocumented have been here longer than 10 years. Most of them, I think about 7 or 8 million of them, are actual workers. The rest are children or are too old to work. But the average undocumented person is young and is employed. And we know from when there was a legalization program a long time ago now, back in 1986, the Department of Labor and other economists followed those folks very carefully, and we could see that there was an increase in wages, a significant one, and that, you know, employers invested more in their employees because they knew they were going to be sticking around, and people invested more in themselves because they knew that they weren't going to be deported. So you had a investment in education and training and just access to better jobs that you have when you have legal status, greater labor mobility, and a more efficient labor market, if you will. So we are in a time now economically that's still fragile, and we can't afford to have people either on the sidelines or getting paid under the table with employers that aren't paying taxes and employees who aren't paying taxes. So the idea is that if you do give people legal status and eventual citizenship, it will create a more efficient and robust economy.
Well, Angela Mira Kelly, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Angela Maria Kelly, who is a Vice President for Immigration Policy and Advocacy at the Center for American Progress, a well-known authority on the policy and the politics of immigration. She has published numerous impactful reports on the economic value of immigration reform, the cost of mass deportation, and the integration trends of America's newcomers. Previously, she served as Director of the Immigration Policy Center, and prior to that was Deputy Director of the National Immigration Forum. She's the author of a new report released by the Center for American Progress, An Economic Analysis on the Impact of Legalizing 11 Million Immigrants Now Living and Working in the Shadows. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the impasse over gun safety legislation passing in the United States Senate.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. William Vizard, who's a professor emeritus and chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of In the Crossfire, A Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And his latest book is Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control. Dr. Vizard served 30 years in law enforcement with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Vizard.
Thank you.
And the husband of the U.S. Congresswoman, Gabriel Giffords, who was shot in Arizona along with a number of other people who died, he was on Fox on Sunday basically arguing that there should be better access to mental health records that could prevent psychologically disturbed people from obtaining guns. It's hard to even believe that we're having a debate over this. I mean, surely isn't there, Dr. Vizard, a national consensus that criminals shouldn't be able to get guns and mentally disturbed people shouldn't be able to get guns?
Well, there's a consensus in the abstract. The problem you have with mentally ill is that, take the Tucson shooting, you have an individual who obviously, in retrospect, appears to have been mentally ill, but nobody had adjudicated him as such, and so legally he wasn't any different than anybody else. And in a way, you have sort of a clash of two concerns here. Advocates for the mentally ill are in opposition, certainly, to randomly tossing people into asylums or even restraining them against their will or labeling them as mentally ill. So all of those are issues. Families are very reticent about going to court to have people declared mentally ill. So not only do you have a problem with records and making the records available, but significant numbers of people who are mentally ill have no such legal status. And most of them are not dangerous to themselves or others, but trying to figure out who is and who isn't is extremely difficult.
Well, already on the Sunday talk shows, for example, Senator Lindsey Graham said that he wouldn't join the filibuster along which, of course, is being threatened by Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz, Imhoff, I believe, as well.
There's a group to draw to.
Yes. So they're determined to block anything, and the president appears to be quite determined to get something done as a result of Newtown. I think you have to believe the president, and I think he exhibited a real emotional connection, I think. He said this, that news of the killing of those children was the worst day of his presidency. And I tend to think that is true. And I think he feels very strongly about it. But these threatening to do the filibuster are equally determined. But one of the things that Lindsey Graham said, which is what the opponents of gun control are saying, is they're saying, well, you know, the person who perpetrated the Newtown massacre, you know, bought guns legally. So background checks don't work, which I guess reinforces the point that you just made. So when you look at what happened with Jared Loughner in Tucson and this Lanza kid in Connecticut, it seems the problem is that the parents recognize the child's mental illness and yet can't restrain them. The parents of Loughner apparently tried at the last minute to take the keys away from his car. They knew he was up to something. And in Lanza's case, he shot his mother, but she was also buying guns and tons of ammunition, et cetera. So is this where the breakdown is at the family level?
Well, I mean, there are all sorts of problems. I mean, it's obviously difficult to decide that because of somebody's illness, and mental illness is an illness, that they should be subjected to some sort of custody, control, or restraints. There's an unwillingness on the part, you know, so that's a societal concern, a concern about individual rights. There's the concern of families. They don't want to label their in many cases, they don't recognize how severe it is. And in other cases, they don't want to label the person as mentally ill, fearing that it will affect them for the rest of their lives. They're always, you know, one is always hopeful about one's children. And then, you know, then we go to the issue of background. I mean, I would disagree with Lindsey Graham's point that background checks make no difference. They certainly aren't a universal solution, but that doesn't mean they don't make any difference. So the problem is there isn't a simple or easy solution to any major social problem or issue, and there certainly isn't an easy solution to this that's readily available to the United States at this point. Probably if we had followed, you know, the British tradition and gone to a nation where gun ownership was highly restricted, we probably wouldn't be having the mass slayings. We might be having other problems, but we probably wouldn't be having the mass slayings. But the horse is already out of the barn on that long ago, and the United States Supreme Court has decided that the Second Amendment is an individual right and a fundamental right. So trying to take the Japanese or the British approach is clearly both historically too late and legally not an option. So,
but Dr. Vizard,
problems at every level.
But there's clearly an asymmetry here between the political determination of the NRA and its followers and the people in the House and the Senate who seem very, very loyal. Either they believe in gun rights, as it's called, or they just don't want to be primaried by the NRA, and they're essentially blackmailed into their position, which I don't know what the figures are on that. But it's pretty clear that the determined minority has more determination than the outraged majority. And as the president said the other day, you know, shame on us if we forget. But the truth of the matter is we do forget. And when these terrible things happen, what happens is the NRA get more members, make more money, and the gun manufacturers sell more product. That's what's so extraordinary about it.
Well, that's you basically described the situation. The problem is the majority is very soft and squishy, and the minority is very, very committed and dogged, and we just don't have a, you know, strong majority in the United States willing to focus on gun regulation, put it at the top of their agenda. There are just too many other issues that people value. And frankly, it's not that strong, although there's a strong majority right now for so-called background checks, and they probably should be called records checks because they're not background checks at all. There's a strong majority. There isn't even a strong majority for any the so-called assault weapon bill, which passed once before and then timed out after 10-year sunset. So we've actually seen support for gun control drop significantly since the 70s, primarily, I would argue, because those people who oppose it have continually made their case, and those people who advocate it have spread their interests over a dozen different issues. And so if you're a legislator in a red state, or even in a swing state, for Republican legislators, the primary, if you vote for any kind of gun legislation, is potentially dangerous. And for a handful of Democrats in swing states, the general election can be dangerous. So that's just become the political reality. And I think one of the reasons you see support drop off is people just become frustrated and shift their focus to something else. The kinds of legislation that seem capable of passing, and this is largely true, are not the kinds of legislation that would have major impact. And so people just lose interest or get disheartened or move on to something else.
So, Dr. Vizard, do you think then that what Mayor Bloomberg is doing of putting in TV ads in districts where some of these wavering senators and congresspeople are that may be persuaded, and then in the broader sweep of time and politics, isn't it likely that the soccer mums, et cetera, will grow more powerful and the gun rights fundamentalists will grow less numerous?
Oh, I think if you look at the 20 to 30 year down the road, if any of us can understand what's going to happen 20 to 30 years from now, but if you look 20 or 30 years down the road at demographics, demographics are not on the side of the NRA. As the country becomes, as the current younger voters move up, they tend to be less likely to be gun owners, less likely to be shooters. Hunting has declined significantly in the United States and is going to continue to decline. All you have to do is look at the number of hunting licenses and who obtains them and access to hunting. I mean, as we become a more urban society, it becomes more difficult and expensive. So there are a whole host of reasons that over 20 or 30 years, demographics are not on that side. But in the foreseeable future, it's a different dynamic. And, it's very difficult in the United States to argue against a right. Americans, whoever captures the language of rights in the United States, Benjamin Barber, a well-known political scientist, has argued all American political thinking is about, and arguments are about rights. All the American language is about rights. You see that, for instance, in the abortion issue with the right to life and the right to choose. Everybody wants to grab the high ground and claim that they're representing a right. And Americans tend to defer to that, and particularly individual rights as opposed to collective rights. And right now, the NRA and its supporters are winning that argument predominantly.
Well, but they're also winning in terms of, for want of a better description, legislative aggressiveness. The way that they managed to get these bills in, like the sunset clause and the ban on assault weapons that died in 2004 because of this sunset clause they slipped in. Always the gun control people are always compromising, and that unfortunately seems to be a pattern with Democrats, that they give in, whereas Republicans are much more determined. And you can see that this is already happening now in the latest funding bill. The NRA, through legislators, slipped in a clause that meant that gun stores didn't have to do inventories, which
they've been using the funding bills for some time. Although both parties have used funding bills to accomplish things that they didn't want to deal with as primary legislation. But recently, the NRA is very adept at lobbying. I mean, they are a very, very adept lobbying organization. Now, you see conservatives losing in other arguments. I mean, if the gay marriage, and actually more than a gay marriage agenda, the anti-homosexual agenda, if you will, has just collapsed. Immigration is largely, I think, collapsing. But on the gun issue, because there just hasn't been the shift in the politics of it, it stayed much more resistant. And I don't see it changing quickly. I do see it changing over the very long run, but I don't see it changing within the foreseeable future.
Well, in the last minute, Dr. Azad, your former organization that you were with for a number of years, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, it doesn't even have a leader because of Republican filibusters. Is there any way to make that agency stronger so that you can actually have
I don't know. They've been a political goat since they came into existence as a separate bureau in 1972. Probably if we just took a rational organizational approach, we would just merge them with the FBI and be done with it. But neither they nor the FBI want that, and certainly the lobby groups don't. So I don't know that it'll happen. But I think they'll continue to be vulnerable. They're a relatively politically weak agency. You know, the Democrats aren't going to sacrifice themselves to protect ATF,
but the laws that the NRA have passed protect criminals. It's a fact. ATF can't trace guns. I mean, that's crazy.
There are dysfunctional statutes. There clearly are, and we have never made up our mind what we want to do about guns in the United States. We're very ambivalent about it, and frankly, the laws ATF has to work with are often contradictory and difficult to enforce, and. The NRA makes a big deal about the fact that there aren't prosecutions of certain statutes in certain places. But the reality is that the federal courts are so overloaded that there aren't all kinds. I mean, they don't prosecute the majority of tax cases. They don't prosecute the majority of immigration cases. I mean, the vast majority.
Right.
They don't prosecute theft from interstate commerce. I mean, the federal courts just are incapable of handling the number of federal crimes that exist. So,
right. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, Dr. Vazard, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. William Vazard, Professor Emeritus and Chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of In the Crossfire, A Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and his latest book is Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control. Dr. Vazard served for 30 years in law enforcement with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how gay adoption has gone under the radar.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Don't you give me a brand new start. So let me live.
So let me live.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alison Gash, who's a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. She's completing a manuscript entitled Below the Radar, How Silence Can Save Civil Rights, which will be published in 2014. And she has an article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alison Gash.
Thanks a lot.
So before we get into your article in the Washington Monthly, Alison, just to get an overview of what happened last week, obviously a very dramatic week in the Supreme Court in terms of the country moving forward on rights, but it seems to be sort of come down, if you can read the tea leaves in the Supreme Court, to an argument over states' rights versus gay rights, particularly with the Prop 8 case. Mm-hmm. What's your takeaway from both DOMA and the Prop 8 hearings?
I think that the Supreme Court is going to be a little bit cautious about overturning all constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. I suspect what they'll probably do is either through a technicality or just by actually ruling on the merits. I think Prop 8 will probably end up being struck down in some fashion. And then my guess is for DOMA that they'll probably actually go ahead and strike that down if there isn't a standing issue. So, you know, I think reading the tea leaves, it's gonna look like what most people have been saying. They're gonna take the sort of moderate approach.
Well, there's an article in the New York Times over the weekend. Obviously, somebody had some sources on the court for the article, which talked about how the court decided to take up these gay rights issues and to take these cases. And what the article indicated was that the really arch-conservatives on the court, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito, felt that they should take the case up early before the country turns. And the country, as you know, has changed dramatically, even since the Prop 8, in terms of polling. So that's an extremely cynical revelation, if that is the case, that they thought, that the conservatives on the court thought, we better take this up now while the country's still opposed to, or at least the constituency is. So what's your sense of that?
I mean, that intuitively makes sense because, you know, certainly it didn't seem from the hearings that Kennedy had any interest in taking up the case. And it certainly didn't seem like at least Ginsburg would be interested in going further than what the Ninth Circuit had done. So it didn't seem like there was any real incentive on the part of key members of the voting liberal bloc or swing voters to actually take the case. So it does make sense that it was the four conservatives that wanted to hear the case. And, you know, common sense tells you they wanted to hear the case in order to make sure that Prop 8 was upheld. But nevertheless, I still think there's probably, you know, there's probably enough of a critical mass or a majority on the court to either rule on these technicalities, which by default ends up striking down Prop 8, or to actually rule on the merits of Prop 8.
So, Alison Gash, let's turn to your article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. And it seems sort of counterintuitive in a way, because since gay marriage is so contentious, and as you know from this week in the Supreme Court, there were pro and con groups in front of the court screaming at each other. But you're suggesting that while this has been going on, that very quietly under the radar, adoption involving children of gay or gay parents adopting children, which you would think that the public would be even more skittish about that than they are about gay marriage, has proceeded apace and is, in fact, in many ways, fairly consolidated in law and fact. So that's odd, isn't it? I mean,
It is. And that's, you know, it was initially when I started on this project, I was looking for yet another instance of when civil rights litigation produced big backlash. And so I turned, you know, I was intending on writing a book about marriage and adoption and a whole host of other issues where we see this big sort of backlash effect. And it was much to my surprise in 2006 when I first started on this project that none of the 16 states that had some sort of initiative or some sort of legislation in motion actually produced any meaningful backlash. And so I started to dig and dig and dig. And so I found that, in fact,
you know, there were a significant number of states, and, you know, at the time, 2006, far more states than had permitted marriage equality, far more cases involving co-parenting and adoption than it had involved marriage equality, and yet very little backlash, very little attention paid by conservatives. And so I started to interview some folks and found that there was a really interesting story about strategy there on the part of the advocates for same-sex parenting to keep this deliberately off the public agenda. And they've been able to do so in a really effective way, which I think has produced some benefits for the marriage debate. And that's sort of the, you know, the interesting conclusion to the story is that these have been mutually beneficial.
So is that to say then that the proponents of gay marriage have made a tactical error by having a public fight?
No, not at all. And you know what the what the article mentions and what the book spells out in greater detail is that there are some issues that are well suited for these below the radar tactics. Marriage was not one of them. And it's actually, if you look back at the dawning of the modern movement for same-sex marriage, it really was intended to be a very sort of incremental state-by-state approach, one that wasn't supposed to ultimately produce this counter movement. But, you know, the initial case was launched by individuals who were interested in marriage. It wasn't even launched by gay rights groups, but once it had been launched, they intended on trying to contain visibility. But it's hard to do that when you're talking about, talking about gay rights and discrimination and talking about a constitutional issue. But those were two things that, in the parenting front, parenting advocates could control. So they didn't have to make this about a gay rights issue. They made it about children's welfare. They didn't have to make it through a constitutional argument. They made it instead through family law and through technical precedent achieved through a multitude of court cases. So they were able to eliminate two of the more polarizing aspects of the gay marriage debate.
Again, I'm speaking with Alison Gash. She's a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. She is completing a manuscript entitled Below the Radar, How Silence Can Save Civil Rights, which will be published in 2014. And she has an article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. Of course, just to touch on this notion of tactics and of being below the radar, in many ways, not in many ways, but certainly in part, the passage of Prop 8 here in California happened, I think, because those that were opposing Prop 8 in their advertising weren't sure about what they were going to say. Their first group of ads that they put out, you didn't even know what they were about. They were so circumspect about even defending gay rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in many ways it helped Prop 8 pass, because one of the ways to overturn Prop 8, if the Supreme Court doesn't rule in its favor, would be to have another initiative here in the state of California that would be able
right.
to negate it. And the polls indicate that it would pass handily. And
yeah.
that's one of the big changes since 2008, is how mm-hmm. much the public have become educated about this issue. So I think there's an example of not having your ducks in a row and having your arguments together and not going public with them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I think, one of the lessons that we've learned over the past few years with the initiatives supporting same-sex marriage that have worked is that they actually took a page from these parenting advocates, and they focused on children's welfare. They focused on the benefits. They focused on things that, a greater majority of the public could agree on. So instead of focusing it specifically on gay rights, they made a shift, they shifted their tactics to match some of the arguments that opponents were making, right? So opponents have always been about children's welfare, procreation, child rearing, to a degree they've talked about religion, but mostly it's been about these child-focused issues. And just recently, the supporters of same-sex marriage have shifted their tactics as well, and that's worked. Which isn't to say that that's the only reason why these recent initiatives have worked, but it is to say that, it certainly seems to be a better strategy in these polarizing times.
Well, if Justice Kennedy is a swing vote, and if we're all trying to figure out what he's thinking, in order to know what the ruling is going to be in June. The fact that Justice Kennedy, focused on children quite a bit and talked about the 44,000 children of gay parents who were growing up feeling inadequate in the sense that their parents weren't legitimized by society or their marriages weren't legitimized by society, and that was a burden on the children. That was actually pretty encouraging. So I guess it's working.
That's right. And I think that's where the really interesting story about how these two issues, parenting and marriage, although they were, you know, decided in very separate spheres and decided using very different strategies, ultimately the strategy used by the parenting folks to keep it below the radar and build up this mass of support across the states has paid off for the marriage folks. Because now they can say, well, in California, it doesn't make any sense for there not to be marriage if marriage is specifically about child rearing and procreation, because in fact, gay parents are raising kids. So if it's true that we want to have marriage to preserve, you know, an optimal child rearing environment, it makes no sense that you would then have a state that has progressive laws with respect to gay parenting. And so you can make that argument. You can punch holes in the rationale and the reasoning of the opposition because of the existence of these states that allow same-sex couples to parent in the same ways that heterosexual couples do.
And in terms of the states we're talking about, Delaware, the District of Columbia, Illinois, Indiana, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Vermont, I guess, and also California, what other states?
Allow second-parent adoption?
Yeah.
Let's see, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, just D.C., Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Maine, Massachusetts, Nevada, New Hampshire, New York, New Jersey, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, Washington, and then roughly six or seven other states where counties, individual counties, allow second-parent adoptions to occur. So places like Michigan, Maryland, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, New Mexico, Minnesota, West Virginia. So there's these things are happening both at the state level and then at the individual county level through individual family court justices.
But in terms of states, it looks like the entire South is opposed to parenting.
Yeah, I mean, except for these spots where you've got individual counties, right? So so what a lot of gay couples do is they'll travel down to the county that allows it and they'll get their second parent adoption there.
I see.
So there are opportunities.
So, and obviously the state of Utah, which is dominated by the Mormon Church, it's not happening there, right?
No. So Utah actually has a specific law that prohibits cohabiting non-marital couples from adopting and gives preference to married couples. So, yeah, they've got some fairly strict prohibitions.
So, Alison Gash, again, professor of political science at the University of Oregon and author of a forthcoming book, Below the Radar, How Silence Can Save Civil Rights. And she has an article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. So the idea of the legal precedent of the best interests of the child as a legal doctrine, that goes back to the mid-1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And that has basically been the core of this change that you're talking about that's happened under the radar.
That's right.
So now there was a period in the late 1970s when you had that country singer who promoted orange juice in Florida,
right.
Anita Bryant. She came out with a thing called Save Our Children. I guess that didn't work. What happened in terms of the opposition here? Did they sort of get distracted from children and move on to adults getting married? I mean, you know, there's an asymmetry in this country between activists on the right and activists on the left. The activists on the right have an awful lot more energy and are more effective, even if their numbers are small, than those on the left. So I'm just curious to know.
Right. Well, so the Anita Bryant story is interesting. So she's responding to an anti-discrimination ordinance that was passed in her county. And so her concern wasn't necessarily about, adoption specifically, even though her campaign was about Save Our Children. What she was concerned about was this idea that gays and lesbians could now argue that they shouldn't be discriminated against in a range of things at the county level. And so she organized this organization called Save Our Children in order to frame her opposition to these anti-discrimination ordinances around children, right? She's a smart lady. She realized that if we focus on children's welfare, that's going to be the thing that amasses the most support across individuals. So she uses that as the frame to repeal that anti-discrimination measure and then ultimately takes it on the road, right? So other people copied some of her strategies. She went and supported other people's strategies. And ultimately, she's able to get a handful of repeals passed to undo some of the progress that gays and lesbians were able to make at the county level in the form of these ordinances. But what she didn't focus on, oddly, was adoption, right? She wasn't specific to the issue of adoption. But Florida, the Florida legislature, was moved by her arguments about children and nevertheless ended up passing a law saying that they were going to restrict adoptions to only heterosexual individuals, single or couples. So they were the only state to actually really take her literally and pass this ban. New Hampshire did later in the mid-1980s and then ended up repealing it 9 years later. So the Florida, that Florida ban was on the books for a long time. It ended up being overturned by a state court just a few years ago. But that was really the most draconian of the measures that were against gay parents. But the Bryant campaign, although it was framed in children, was about these anti-discrimination ordinances.
So it's a bit paradoxical, isn't it, or a bit ironic, I suppose, that what, about at least half, if not more, of heterosexual marriages end up in divorce. Has that ever been brought forth, or is this issue of gay adoption so much below the radar that those issues aren't even brought up? It really is about the best interests of the child.
Yeah, so, you know, what's been really interesting about this tactic is that they haven't, you know, gay and lesbian advocates are not, they're not taking sort of a big policy stand in the sort of, you know, with the sort of frames that you're suggesting. What they're doing is they're saying, look, kids need stability, right? They're actually taking a page right out of conservative arguments. Kids need stability. You know, if you can get a two-parent family, even better. They deserve to have the ties to their parents that kids raised in heterosexual households have. And so they really take it specifically from the lens or through the lens of the kids that are being raised in these families. And they keep the issue of gay rights out of the rhetoric.
Well, I must say there's a charming show on television which is quite popular called Modern Family.
That's right.
With the gay couple who have the sassy young adopted Asian kid.
That's right.
That, I think, is, if that's a reflection of the reality, then we're in good shape here.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I actually, you know, there is an important role here to be played by popular media. You know, and the fact that we end up seeing, you know, not just the token gay person here or there, but gay couples raising kids, you know, I think it really normalizes things for people, and it really, you know, it really hammers home for people that these are families, just like anyone else's families, that are being affected by these, you know, by these ridiculous restrictions.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alison Gash.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Alison Gash. She's a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. She's completing a manuscript entitled Below the Radar, How Silence Can Save Civil Rights, which will be published in 2014. And she has an article in the Washington Monthly, Under the Gaydar, How Gays Won the Right to Raise Children Without Conservatives Even Noticing. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Bye for now.